Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. What a week it's been from an Arsenal perspective. A win in the North London Derby. Harry Kane fell over, then he got back up again, then he slid in, then he gave an assist to Bukayo Saka. Arsenal won the Derby 3-1. The momentum has changed. It looks like we could potentially be a football team again, which is nice. On top of that, the Arsenal women beat Manchester City 5-0 on Sunday, then thrashed Spurs 5-1 to reach the semi-finals of the FA Cup. So it has been a good week to be a Gooner, and let's hope that we get plenty more of those between now and May, because man, isn't it just so much better when stuff like this happens, when we, you know, play well, don't lose, don't do stupid things, and don't annoy the shite out of all of us? Isn't it just much better? Aren't you happier? I know I am. We will have some Arsenal women chat a bit later on with Tim. He'll be here to talk about Jonas Eidevall, the start to his career as head coach of Arsenal women, their incredible start to the new season, and lots more. In a couple of moments' time, Nick Ames is here. We'll be chatting to him about all things Arsenal as well. Just a couple of things before we get into that. One, I want to say thank you very much indeed to everybody who sent birthday wishes on Sunday. I turned 50. It was a day of weird introspection, and then Arsenal made it all the better. Thank you very much indeed for all the messages. There were lots of tweets and lots of emails, and it's really difficult to reply to all of them. Emails I will do. I've got a backlog of emails to get through, so if you've sent me something of late, I'm not ignoring it. It's just been a really weird, difficult, stressful couple of weeks off the pitch, if you want to use that expression. I will get around to it. I just wanted to say thank you very much indeed to all of you for those very kind birthday wishes. And I'm now 50 and a bit, and I'm feeling okay about it now. I was a bit freaked out on Sunday, but hey, what can you do? The other thing is, if you enjoyed the Ian Wright It's a Great Day jingle, you can find it to listen to and to download on SoundCloud. We have it on the SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/arsblog, and you'll see it up there. There is a way to download, particularly on desktop. I'm not sure about mobile, but if you're on a desktop computer, there's three little dots there, and if you click that, you get the option to download the file. I know a lot of you wanted to use the MP3 as your ringtone. Actually, what I'll do as well is I'll upload it to the site, to arsblog.com. So if you want to use it as your ringtone, if you want to download it on your phone right now, just go to the show notes and you will find a link to open/download the MP3. I don't know how you set it as a ringtone or whatever. I don't do that anymore. Not since all the crazy frog stuff, you know. But look, it'll be there. There's a link in the show notes right now, and you can download the Ian Wright It's a Great Day jingle from there. Okay, let's get on with it, and delighted to welcome to the show, as I said earlier, from The Guardian, Nick Ames. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Andrew. Nice to be here. How are you?
Good, thank you. We should talk about Emile Smith Rowe and Bukayo Saka, because clearly they are really important pieces of this particular Arsenal puzzle. And we saw evidence of that, of course, on Sunday in the Derby when both of them scored, both of them got an assist. Gareth Southgate said today that Emile Smith Rowe was very close to making the England squad, which tells you just, you know, what level of performance he's putting in. And Bukayo Saka, we know already. Just starting with Smith Rowe, one of the things that people were looking for from him this season was maybe a bit more end product. He has scored in the past, and he scored all throughout his youth career. but it can take a player a little while at times to sort of find their goal scoring feet at senior level. It's a very nice way to make progress in that regard when you score the opening goal in a North London derby.
It really is, and it's funny because right before kickoff, I was having a conversation with my colleague Dave Heitner from The Guardian, who I'm sure some people may have read, and we were talking about Smith Rowe, and I was saying a very similar thing. I was saying that for all the brilliant industry and tempo and creativity and vigour that he adds to the team, what we maybe needed to see next was, for want of a better way of putting it, increased numbers when it came to end product, maybe goals and assists. Now, I was quite encouraged by the way he came on against Wimbledon last week and got a bit of a poacher's goal, didn't he, inside the box when it kind of fell for him. And I felt that late run he made to get on the end of Saka's cutback and put it away so coolly, quite beautifully, was exactly the kind of thing that, if we're being harsh, he had been missing. And to add that to his game is quite something. And I think he's always had that timing. I think people who've watched him at youth level, under 23 level, even out on loan, would probably agree. But it's not always straightforward to translate that, I think, for a young player into senior football. Sometimes you're a little bit more cautious about how you bomb on, how you gamble in the box and stuff like that at first. And I think he is adding that, and I think he can do it. I don't know that we should be putting pressure on him to score 15 goals a season, but I think he can push on from here. I think he's definitely got that in his locker. And I was delighted to see that be so conspicuously added to his game over the last week or so. And I think there's a lot more to come from him there. And I think, we all know how dynamic he is. I think we even saw, I keep talking about the Wimbledon game, which was not the most important game of the last week, but he did come on and lift a fairly mediocre performance almost single-handedly with the energy and verve that he brought to it. And if you're adding those numbers as well in and around the penalty box, then you are one hell of a player. And it is no surprise that he was so close to being in the England squad. There were a few murmurs that he was around it potentially, and I'm pretty sure that if he keeps this form going, he'll be very much in the mix next month.
The number 10 at Arsenal, at any big football club, is a big number. It's a big number to take on. It's a big number to inherit. We've seen some incredible players wear that number in the past, but also with it comes, you know, an expectation of performance as well, doesn't it? I know you say, like, we can't put pressure on him for 15 goals a season. That seems unrealistic. But you're also the number 10 at a club like Arsenal. And maybe it's not quite the Arsenal of the past, but it's an Arsenal that wants to get back there. And a key part of that is a player in his position. So I don't know if it's just something we talk about as football fans, but do you think he would have felt any pressure of that number? Or is that something that he would absolutely relish and take on? Like, with the 10 comes that challenge, and with that challenge comes a way of driving yourself and motivating yourself.
Yeah, you know what, it's quite funny because I was walking to the game on Sunday, and for about half of my walk I was walking down Hornsey Road right behind a guy with a Smith Rowe 10 shirt, and I was kind of thinking to myself, wow, you know, for a boy from South London, but who's been in the Arsenal set up for that long, how often has this ever happened? How often does it happen? What a thing for him to be playing in a derby wearing number 10 with people flocking to the ground wearing his shirt. I was trying to put myself in his shoes, and obviously I couldn't do that, but it seemed such a special thing. I think Smith Rowe really wanted that number 10 shirt. I think he was very much up for it. It was very much something that he wanted to seize. I don't think it's cowed him at all. I think he's someone who shows up for things. We've seen that all over the pitch. Never hides and wants the ball, keeps coming even if things aren't coming off. And I think it was a challenge from talking to people around the situation that he actively wanted in the summer and was never going to turn down. And I think he's got that kind of personality where he's happy to take on those new challenges and really handle the pressure. And I don't think we've seen him wilt at all since he got that break in the team on Boxing Day.
Bukayo Saka played from the right, and we saw him play from the right a lot last season, and I'm of the opinion that he's got the quality to play pretty much anywhere, you know, behind the striker, in midfield, and what have you. But I think there's a growing sense, or whatever it might be, that Bukayo Saka from the right-hand side is probably the most effective Bukayo Saka when it comes to him producing and influencing games, not just with goals, not just with assists, but how he plays and what he brings to the team in that position. Is that something that you would share, his effectiveness from the right-hand side over other areas of the pitch? And B, what about the dilemma that it then presents Arsenal, because they have a very expensive player in Nicolas Pepe who, you know, I don't want to make this about his price tag, but primarily that is where he plays. And if Arsenal have Bukayo Saka doing what he does, it is a bit of a challenge to get both of these guys in the team.
It is. I mean, first of all, on Bukayo Saka, I think we all know he would probably give you a 7 out of 10 every week wherever he played, except maybe in goal. Like he is that good and that tuned in to football and to what a coach wants and to what his job is on a pitch. I completely agree. I've thought for quite a while that right-sided role is probably his best. I mean, he's such a fascinating player because he can do the flying winger stuff, you know, going outside his man and a trick or two. But I think there's a lot of a sort of David Silva about him, the kind of coming in and combining in little drops of a shoulder, little clever passes here and there, link-ups with a striker, with his number 10, everything. And I just think that is the role that looks most natural to him. He's good at going inside his man, good at going outside his man, good at popping up, maybe helping out in that number 10 position too. And I think what puts him ahead of Pepe is simply that ability to do that, the game intelligence, if you like, the knowing how to play the role tactically that we haven't always seen from Pepe. Pepe's got some fantastic attributes. We know that he can beat his man. He's got a left foot that I think is quite clearly the best at the club, which I'm always expecting to put a shot on target when he unleashes it. But I think Saka is ahead of him in that position for now. I don't think that banishes Pepe or anything like that. I think there's going to be injuries, there's going to be lack of form, there's going to be games piling up later in the season. There's going to be times when Arteta does want to mix things up and make use of the fact that he does have a very flexible front line. I think that's a really good thing about what Arsenal have got now. You could play Smith Rowe out wide or in the middle. You could play Saka, as we've discussed, in any of those positions. You could play Pepe left or right. There's a lot of options to mix things up. But I do think Pepe, just in terms of maybe the subtlety to his play and the combinations and the intensity and the nuance that has been added to what maybe in previous years has been a bit of a sterile front line behind the striker, I think Saka brings a lot more to it.
It feels sometimes as if Pepe is just not quite suited to the way Mikel Arteta wants to play, if you like, that he brings this element of chaos to proceedings, which can be really, really useful. And in full flight, of course, he is, he's really effective. I think he was second or maybe had the most goal contributions last season when you combine goals and assists. So there is like mature, developed end product in there, but it's always felt to me like there's a slight incompatibility between him and perhaps the style of the coach, which can be a bit galling when the style doesn't work or when Arsenal aren't achieving results. It's difficult maybe to understand, you know, what he's doing with a player like Pepe. But when it comes off, when it, the system, when the formation, when it delivers like it did on Sunday in the Derby, you can see, you know, how it might be difficult for him to win his place back.
Yeah, I think Saka is just, for somebody of his age, an extraordinarily plugged in and intelligent character. I don't think I've come across too many young players who play in his positions, especially who are maybe quite as savvy and tactically plugged in. I keep saying that, but I think it's the right phrase as he is. And I think that's a lot of the reason why Arteta, the coaches, and so many people around the club absolutely love him. Pepe, I don't think he has got that. I think he's got better, actually, in terms of his game and understanding and his combinations. And I think that towards the end of last season, I was kind of thinking to myself, is Pepe going to be one of those players who he blows up in the new season? You know, haven't seen it yet. He's not really had the chance to do it. I think it is going to be very hard for him to win his place back, but I also think there will be opportunities. I just I can't see for 1 minute that we're going to have a season where all of the 11 who are now playing so well are fit and firing, or that we're going to have a scenario where Arteta doesn't want to mix things up a bit and use that versatility and variety that he now has got that he's maybe not had before.
Let's talk about Granit Xhaka a bit, because his start to the season wasn't great, obviously. He was sent off against Manchester City. He was in the team when Arsenal were losing. He went away with Switzerland and couldn't play because he caught COVID. He came back. He came straight back into the team. I think he played pretty well against Spurs, but obviously he's picked up a significant injury, is what Arsenal said. It could have been worse. He's got medial knee ligament damage. Going to be out for 3 months. Whether people are favorably disposed to Granit Xhaka or not, he is a player that Mikel Arteta and managers before him have relied on. We could debate whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's still a statement of fact that when he's available, he pretty much plays all the time for Mikel Arteta. So this absence leaves him with some thinking to do. When he lost a key player last season in Kieran Tierney, he overthought it, in my opinion. He played Granit Xhaka at left back, which I don't think was the right thing to do, because it meant changing so much else about the way that the team was structured in order to try and find balance with Xhaka in that position. I'm hoping he's kind of learned from that, and he does have options to him. We saw against Burnley, there was the more 4-3-3 where he had Partey and he had Odegaard and Smith Rowe, and maybe this is what gets Pepe back into the team. Who knows? Because he then had space for an extra attacking player. That is another option to him. But he also has another big summer signing in Albert Sambi-Lokonga, who will be relishing the opportunity to take Xhaka's place, I guess. So it will be interesting to see how he decides he's going to deal with the Xhaka absence. You feel like there are certain games which would suit that 4-3-3 more, others where Partey is going to need a bit more help, and that's probably where Lokonga will come in.
Yeah, firstly, I do feel sorry for Xhaka after his performance on Sunday, because, okay, there's the school of thought that maybe him playing that well was just a bonus and the team's evolving, that he'll be phased out of it eventually anyway. But I thought he put in exactly the kind of performance that shows what he can do. I think if you put in the kind of movement that Arsenal have now got, that we've spoken about a bit, behind the attacker and in those wide positions, then having a player like Xhaka who can kind of unlock it with some of his passes from deep, it kind of plays to each other's strengths. And I thought he was fantastic at that, especially in the first half on Sunday. I thought he was absolutely outstanding. And I wrote a piece about it from the Emirates, actually. I decided pretty much by half time that I was going to write my sidebar article, which is a sort of supplementary piece to the match report that we do about Granit Xhaka. And it was very interesting reading below the line in the comments section the next morning, which is not normally a wise place for a journalist to venture. But I looked beneath it, and it was about 300 Arsenal fans commenting. And I would say about 50% of them were saying, what the hell are you on about? He was a walking red card. And the other 50% were, yeah, he was fantastic. Yeah, too right, can't agree. And can't agree more. And that kind of sums up his Arsenal career and perceptions of him in a nutshell, doesn't it? He's absolute Marmite. But he was very good. I think you can see why Arteta put him in. Yeah, a bit of help for Partey, who is going to need that. And I think what this will probably do, I think, is hasten perhaps the evolving towards the 4-3-3 that you just mentioned, which can also sometimes become a bit of a 4-1-4-1, can't it, with Partey that bit deeper and making use out wide a bit more. So I think we might see a Brighton Partey in there with Odegaard and Smith Rowe slightly ahead, could be a chance for Pepe. That means out wide. I think Sambi Lokonga has done enough so far to prove that he is a very credible option to go alongside Partey in there. What I love about Lokonga, and I loved it even in that Brentford game that was otherwise completely unspeakable from an Arsenal perspective, was that he plays with his head up all the time. He's got the next move, and he's got the next move mapped out in his head. And in that regard, he almost reminded me a little bit of a Jack Wilshere or someone like that. That's only one way in which I'm comparing them. But he has got that kind of scanning, I think they call it, ability. So I don't think he'd let anyone down if he played in there. And I think he would be Arteta's next choice ahead of someone like Maitland-Niles or Elneny. I think we may well see that set up with Partey alongside Lokonga or someone in the bigger games, you know, the equivalent games to Spurs. I mean, I think Liverpool's only a month away now, isn't it? Something like that. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if this kind of, not forced Arteta's hand, but hastened what we know he wants to do, which is move towards that 4-3-3 kind of setup that clearly he is the most comfortable with playing.
There is a big onus now on Thomas Partey, A, to stay fit, but B, to deliver the kind of performances that Arsenal will have paid the money for. That Arsenal, you know, they paid a big transfer fee to Atletico Madrid. He was unlucky in his first season. He did have injuries. He picked up an injury, unlucky again at the start of this season. But with Xhaka absent, he really is the senior man in the key area of the pitch and the key area of the team now. So I think it's well within his capabilities to be that guy, to be that prominent player, to be that leader, if you like, in terms of how he plays. But you know, it is a precarious situation as well, given his injury track record, that if something goes wrong with him again, Arsenal begin to look very, a bit callow in there. That would be, maybe that's a bit harsh, but you know what I mean? There's a definite lack of experience. You know, you could use Elneny, but that's not going to excite anyone. So there is a big weight of responsibility on Thomas Partey's shoulders now.
Yeah, Partey was signed specifically, I think, to facilitate that move towards a 4-3-3, because he is good enough, as you've said, to hold it all together from deep. And I thought, looking back at that Chelsea friendly, when he got injured, I think it was early in the second half, but I remember watching the first half of that and just thinking he is two times the player that I saw last season for Arsenal. He had gone up a couple of gears. He looked fit. He was probably the best player on that pitch. He looked like a player who could absolutely dominate matches against anyone. Now he's back again. I thought he was outstanding alongside Xhaka against Spurs. I think he's got that ability both to play those passes on the ball maybe quite quickly and sharply that maybe other Arsenal midfielders don't have. He can move the ball on very quickly over a distance as well. But he's got that defensive now that we all know about. He knows when to sit. He knows when to clean up. Just needs to work on the shooting, really. So I think he is now vital. I think, as you've alluded to, Arsenal are kind of one Thomas Partey injury away from what we'd call a midfield crisis, I guess. But let's not go that far. And it's asking a lot. It is asking a lot for him to play the next... I mean, I think I worked out Xhaka's going to miss 14 games in the Premier League if the prognosis is accurate to the week. It's asking a lot for Partey to play all of them. We haven't seen him do that yet. Then again, he wasn't a particularly injury-prone sort of constant member of the Atletico Madrid treatment room. So maybe the law of averages says... And it will be helped by the fact that there aren't many midweek games coming up. Law of Averages says it's about time he got a good run of games together. In which case, I think that does help Arteta to be able to push on and play that 4-3-3, because you've got that stability with Partey in there that he hasn't had before. Also helps that there's now a fairly stable centre-back partnership, I think, White and Gabriel, that maybe there hasn't been for a few years. So I think the tools are there, but you're right. There's a lot on Partey's shoulders now. You don't really want to contemplate too much the options if he's not there. But I don't really know whether that means they need to look in January adding more depth to that position, really, because you would think that with Partey and Xhaka, normally that's two senior experienced players who are fit most of the time and able to do the job in there. And then you've got players like Lekonga, Maitland-Niles and Elneny if you need who can back it up. So I don't know whether the resources are particularly slim. I think they'd just be very unlucky if they lost both Xhaka and Partey.
Yeah, it's, you know, Xhaka's fairly robust. I don't think he's ever had a real serious injury during his what feels like many, many, many years at Arsenal. But hopefully he can recover fully and get back soon. But let's talk just a little bit about Mikel Arteta. And, you know, as somebody who is on the beat, if you like, and has worked the press conferences and you've been able to see the way he's operated, do you detect a fairly big change in his demeanor over the last few weeks? We keep referencing on the Arscast Extra, myself and James, this idea that, you know, the post-Man City funk was the best 10 or 15 days of his career. And, you know, on face, if you take it at face value, it seems a bit mad to say something like that. But there was an interesting comment from Lokonga when he was talking in midweek to a Belgian football magazine, where he said the start to the season, paraphrasing here, basically made everyone come together. Arteta has elicited 3 wins from a team which, you know, maybe in other circumstances or for other coaches might well have downed tools. We've seen that happen in easier ways before, but I don't think you can win the games that Arsenal did in the manner in which they won them without having the players on board, without some belief in what you're doing, some togetherness within the squad and everything else. So, you know, it feels like he's appreciative of that support, whether, you know, it's one thing getting the endorsement from the board, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing for football managers is another question. But you know it, by the way, that your players do what you ask them to do or don't do what you ask them to do. And clearly, over those last 3 games, they've worked really hard, played really, really well against Spurs, as well as working hard. So little green shoots, little steps forward. And I think he is in some ways appreciative / humble by it, and you can see that in the way that he talks.
Yeah, I think he was relieved as well, because I think, you know, you put together a fairly expensive, fairly new team, or at least a half of a new team almost, and then you have the start of a season that Arsenal had, some of which was in their power, a lot of which wasn't, as we know. There was COVID issues and other things, and then you all begin on that kind of footing. You know, it could stretch the belief of any new arrival. It could stretch the motivation of the squad that is already there. So I think when he saw in that week and a half, 2 weeks off, that they were fighting for him and that they were listening to his ideas and that they were totally on board with it, I think, as he said already, I think it must have been a massive boost for him, a massive vote of confidence, because at the end of the day, if the players aren't on board, it doesn't matter what your board of directors think of you, it doesn't matter what the fans think of you, anything like that. And I think we can see, I mean, I've pretty much just come off one of his press conferences, actually, the pre-match for Brighton, and I think he's always quite guarded in his dealings with the media. I think the Zoom format doesn't help, because you can't really generate much warmth in the room. And I think a lot of us are fairly hacked off with that by now. But I think you watch him during the games and there's that bit of animation about him. I think the interaction with the crowd is so important to him. There was a lovely moment after the Wimbledon game on Wednesday when a lot of the crowd stayed behind to kind of watch the broadcast interviews which have been playing, which have been taking place alongside the side of the pitch these days. And he took loads of selfies and autographs and stuff like that afterwards and had that bit of communion with them that, you know, that he hadn't been able to have for nearly 2 years. And okay, it's a cup game with Wimbledon, who cares? But this was really important to him. You could tell that, and he referenced it afterwards. I think you could see by the intensity of his reactions on Sunday just how much it meant. He was living every moment, kicking every ball on the pitch, and his celebrations were quite something else. So I think he's really rising to the situation around him. I think he's feeding off this extra level of positivity and dynamism that the crowd have got too. And I think he really appreciates as well how the atmosphere has been inside the stadium. I know I was quite interested by some of the debate after the Norwich game, actually, because, you know, a lot sometimes gets made of the Emirates crowd, whether they moan a bit too much or whether it's a positive or negative atmosphere and that kind of thing. But I did think that the atmosphere against Norwich was particularly positive and particularly affirmative and particularly important, given that the team had come off the back of three absolute disasters, given that they didn't play that well against Norwich, who were bottom and hadn't scored, I don't think, but they eked out the win. And I never heard a murmur of dissent or negativity in there. It was fantastic support. And the manager picks up on that. And I think that really boosted him too and maybe led him to say a bit of stuff that he said after the game, because he felt his public were completely behind him. And I think that atmosphere carried on into the Wimbledon game and, you know, times 10 into Spurs. So I think he feels now that maybe for the first time he's got a groundswell of people being behind him from every single angle. And I think maybe in the COVID environment, where so many things are being done remotely, where you can't be face to face with people, when there were no fans for so long in the stadium, it's probably quite easy to be haunted by a bit of self doubt when you haven't really got people in your face telling you that you're good anyway, or giving you that motivation. So I think there's a lot of relief from him, and I think as you say, I'm humbled, grateful. But I think it's justified in what we've seen and what the supporters have seen from how the team has evolved and come together in recent weeks.
Just finally, if Arsenal were to beat Brighton, and look, nobody's taking anything for granted, and Arteta was quite clear in the press conference today, wasn't he, about how, you know, you can't rest on your laurels just because you beat Spurs. You've got to start producing consistently, and that will mean winning games like Brighton. But if they do go to Brighton and win, they'll have 12 points. If Liverpool win their game at the weekend, they'll have 17 points. I think if you said to people there'd be a 5-point difference between Arsenal and the league leaders, you know, after the first three games, stick another four games on that and you'll, you know, be only 5 points behind the league leaders. And this is, I'm not suggesting that this is a title challenge or a charge or anything like that. Just a look at where Arsenal could be if they beat Brighton. It does feel an awful lot better for very, very obvious reasons. But it's also a sign that, like, things can change pretty quickly in football, for good and for worse. So that really does demand that consistency. You know, if we feel better after three games, if Arsenal lose the next three, it'll be straight back into crisis mode.
Yeah, and look, it's a big opportunity coming up now, I think. Massive opportunity. I think Brighton is a very, very hard game. I think if you take the emotional aspect out of it, I think on the pitch it may even be a harder game than Spurs, because I think they're an excellent team. I think they've got quite a few similarities to Arsenal, actually, in the way that Potter sets them up. It'll be interesting. I think a lot might hinge on whether Bissouma's back from injury for Brighton or not, but either way, it's going to be a tough game. But if you look at the run ahead now, and I've just got it in front of me, I think it's Brighton, then it's Palace, and then it's Villa. Then it's Leicester away, who look a bit wobbly. Then it's Watford, and then you've got that Liverpool game in mid to late November. That is a good run of 5 to 6 games. And we've seen before that this team can put a run together. It put a run together at the end of last season, which kind of got swept away a bit because, you know, the finish was still nowhere near good enough. But this is an opportunity in a league that, maybe apart from Man City and Liverpool and Chelsea, is very topsy-turvy, very topsy-turvy. We've seen some funny results already. We've seen teams coming off the back of European games with some weird results. We've seen quite a lot of strange stuff. So I think consistency now is absolutely everything. I think you're right. You'd probably take this position now, and at the proximity to the top 4, 5, 6, a couple of months ago, and I see no reason why Arsenal can't narrow that gap a bit further if they keep winning games. It was a really good run.
All right, well, look, let's hope they can keep doing that. As ever, thanks a million for your time, Nick. Really appreciate it, and we'll catch up soon.
Thanks, Andrew. Cheers.
Thank you very much indeed to Nick. You can read him in The Guardian, and of course you can find him on Twitter at NickAmes82, at NickAmes82. It's a great day.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, I played it again. So what? What are you going to do? Report me to the It's a Great Day police? Come on. You got to milk a win in the derby as much as possible. And look, I'm still feeling very good about that game on Sunday. I'm feeling positive about what it means for our future. Maybe it's misplaced. Maybe I'm just being a crazy old optimist. But I want to enjoy a win like that for as long as possible, even late into the week. But hey, I think we deserve it. I think we as fans have had some tough times already this season, so I think it behooves us to enjoy the good things for as long as possible. Right, as I said earlier, we have some Arsenal women chat and a bit more with Tim Stillman. Hello, Tim.
Hello there.
It's a case of, like, anything you can do, we can do better when it comes to the Arsenal women. Arsenal beat Tottenham on Sunday in the North London Derby 3-1. Arsenal women beat their counterparts 5-1 to reach the semi-finals of the FA Cup, coming after a big win against Manchester City as well. We'll talk about the specifics of those games in a moment, but just overall, what's your take on how things have gone for Jonas Eidevall so far? I mean, am I right in saying that in all of the games that we've played under him, we've never scored fewer than three goals? There have been some huge wins, big wins over big opposition. I mean, is this going better than you could have expected?
100% yes. Particularly beating Chelsea on the opening day and then beating Manchester City 5-0. You know, you talk about the women doing what the men can do better. I mean, they had a 5-0 scoreline against Manchester City,
yeah.
but in their favour on this occasion.
Yeah.
100% it is, yeah. I mean, I think, and there are still some things Jonas and some of the players are talking about, they know they've had a little bit of an advantage in the early part of the season because they had those Champions League qualifiers. They started their season earlier than anyone else. Mm. So particularly in that Chelsea game, for example, they had a bit of an advantage because they'd had three competitive games when they played Chelsea. Whereas Chelsea and Manchester City, well, Chelsea, Man City and Arsenal had lots of players away at the Olympics in July. And most of those teams, what they've had to do is give those players time off, but then get them back late. Mm. What Arsenal had to do was give them no time off at all, well, a couple of days, get them back from Japan and get them playing Champions League qualifiers. So at the moment, that aspect's working really well because they're nice and sharp, but they all acknowledge that that might take a toll later in the season. So they're kind of keeping their feet on the ground about that. But I think what's really, really evident is just how quickly things have changed, both in Arsenal's approach under Jonas. So the squad is bigger. And he rotates it a lot. And he says, look, two aspects. One, we're going to be playing lots of games. Champions League group stage this year for the first time ever. That means more games than ever. I have to rotate. But also the physical demands he puts on the players. He's put on in this kind of new style of play where they're asked to press a lot more.
Mm.
And particularly his wide forwards. There's lots of big quality wide forwards there now. And he's just said, look, they can't play every game because I'm going to ask them to press and run and harry and hassle, and they're not going to be able to play 90 minutes a lot of the time, so I need to be able to sub them off.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more rotation going on. There's a different style of play. But I think really what's happened is just, I said a couple of times on this podcast, it went a bit stale under Joe. I think everyone knows that. And things are just being done slightly differently. And at the moment, it's that honeymoon period where new equals different equals good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was going to ask, was that the main difference between the style of football under Joe, who, you know, was a hugely popular guy. You know, as a manager, I think everyone had a huge amount of time for him. But I think you said one of the question marks was the performance in big games. Is the way that Jonas is asking them to play, in a way, an attempt to try and combat that? So if you're going to play like that in those big games, you've got to play like that in all the other games as well.
Yeah, totally. I think the thing is, like with Joe's style beat all of the teams that Arsenal should have beaten. Like their record against everyone, like other than Chelsea and Man City, was almost perfect, almost. So his style of football beat those teams and beat them easily. But it just couldn't do it in the bigger games. And what's really changed when the Arsenal Man City game on Sunday, which Arsenal won 5-0, just to repeat that, at half time, Arsenal had a 2-0 lead. At half time, Manchester City had 71% possession. And that wasn't even just game state, that was how the game was going from the start. And basically what Arsenal did, it was so pragmatic in terms of, and I spoke to Jonas about this afterwards, and he said, look, we know Man City like to pass the ball and we know they like to have a high line. So we just made the decision, let's sit off them. And then when we get the ball, let's just ping it over the top of their defence. And, you know, not quite late 80s Wimbledon style, you know, long passes rather than like long balls. But the idea this season, and it worked beautifully. They just, honestly, it was just like, you know how the Falklands was a range war and like England had like longer range in their missiles? It was like that. Like Man City just kept passing the ball in front of Arsenal and they just said, whenever you're ready, give it to us. There we go. We'll ping it over the top.
Yeah.
And they just got through them over and over again. That is not the way that Arsenal would have played under Joe Montemurro. But the other thing, kind of key thing that's changed and changed quite quickly, was that under Joe, they had much more of like a snake charmer style in possession. The whole idea was built on, and this really worked against the smaller teams, when teams sit back on us, pass the ball around defence, around midfield, and try and tempt them away. And then when they all kind of creep up the pitch, then go in behind them.
Yeah.
Whereas under Jonas, the idea is much more, get the ball forward a lot more quickly. That doesn't necessarily always mean long balls, but get it forward more quickly. And don't worry if the pass is not hugely accurate, because then you can counter press. And Arsenal got a lot of players that can do that. So the idea is built much more on get the ball forward quickly. And even if you don't get it right, you know, when the opposition defence get it, or they try to clear it, you can pounce on them and get on them again.
Yeah.
And so that's much more the style this time around. And it, I always felt that it suited the forward players that Arsenal have.
Is there a sense that maybe with some of the new arrivals as well, that, you know, there's a bit of star power arrived in Tobin Heath, but the technical level of some of the players that have been brought in has really had a positive impact as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things Jonas keeps talking about in terms of having a slightly bigger squad as well, is he says that's not just useful in the games and the substitutions you can make and things like that, but he says in training, that's really useful because it keeps the level really, really high. And when, you know, like the Tobin Heath signing that you referenced, that was done a few weeks ago, but she stayed in the US for a little bit because she was playing for the US national team and she came over last week. And actually, I think even if it's not by design, that's been kind of the perfect way to do it, because there was the big kind of, oh my God, we're signing Tobin Heath, and it all broke so quickly. And certainly for us anyway, it happened so quickly. The players knew about it. And then there was a bit of a lull for a couple of weeks and Arsenal won some games and started the season. And now she's here and now she's come to London Colney. And, you know, Arsenal made a 13-minute video about her first 48 hours at Arsenal, which that tells you a little bit about her star power, right?
Yeah.
And after both of the games she's been involved in, Arsenal always tweet out a video like of one of the players afterwards saying, you know, thank you to the fans, or buy tickets for the next game, or whatever. Both times, Tobin Heath. Josh Kroenke came over to meet her. Like, they understand both the off-pitch and the on-pitch value of signing this player, particularly when they've got a few big players who've got 1 year on their contracts, who they're trying to convince of their ambition. A signing like Tobin Heath does that, or at least hopefully does that. Anyway, it certainly takes them closer, but definitely. And I think when you look at the form of someone like Beth Mead, who's played well for the last kind of 3-4 seasons that she's been at Arsenal, she's been a mainstay in the team and deservedly so. She's gone up a level this year, and she's probably the best performer at the moment of the season. And I don't think it's a coincidence. Arsenal have brought in Nikita Paris, who she competes with for the right wing berth for England, and Tobin Heath. I don't think it's like any surprise that Beth Mead has gone up another level now.
Yeah, I mean, healthy competition, it's hard sometimes to get that balance right, but it certainly looks as if it's working at the moment. I just want to go back to something that we talked about last time we were talking about Arsenal women, and maybe something we were talking about during the summer as well. I'm just trying to get it up here because I've forgotten it. But basically, it was to do with the sort of internal review of what was going on at Arsenal Women, which was taking place during the summer. It was announced during the summer. I think Vinay spoke about how they're going to invest more than ever before into the women's team. And it came at a time, I think, where all the focus, of course, was on the men's team. And it's hard to see the wood for the trees and everything else. But these things that have been put in place, this internal review, this design, if you like, to try and raise the level of the team, because I don't think it's just about the Women's Super League. Obviously, the Champions League is a big prize and a big ambition for the coach, the players, and for the club as well. But a recognition that maybe it wasn't quite within grasp. It does look as if these things have come together pretty well so far. You know, the new coach, I think we said last time, were we slightly encouraged by some of the decision makers at the executive level making decisions for the women's team, which appear to be like smart and clever? Does that give us some hope for what's happening with the men's team? I think we still have a little way to go, but certainly things are looking a bit better than they were, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. So that whole restructuring, internal review thing appears to be paying off.
Yeah, massive tick. It has to be said, massive tick. Even last night, Jonas was at pains to point out the role of Gary Lewin. Gary Lewin is now the head of medicine and sports science for the women's team. That's the first time that role has ever really existed. They've had like strength and conditioning lead coaches, usually on casual contracts, but they've got, you know, and like a real Arsenal man in Gary Lewin as well. But not just because he's an Arsenal man. Like, we know that he's good at his job. We know he knows his shit on stuff like that. And Arsenal know that. And he'd done some like casual work with the team a couple of years earlier. He's got his own clinic, I believe, with his brother or someone in his family. I can't quite remember.
His cousin, and so, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of the players have used that. So he's familiar with the players anyway. But last night, Jonas, he was asked about squad rotation. And at the moment, you know, I've said one of the big challenges under Joe was injuries. Not sure how far that was Joe's fault or whether that was just because we didn't have someone like Gary Lewin there. Only one injury in the first team squad at the moment. So, you know, Wednesday night, they play Spurs. Vivian Miedema, not even called for, unused sub. And they're able to bring on substitutes like Beth Mead and Kim Little towards the end. So, but the thing he said last night when he was asked about the squad rotation was he said, you can have all the players in the world, but if they're not available, it doesn't matter. And he said in his own words that the biggest signing Arsenal made this summer was Gary Lewin. Just to have that level of expertise and to have, and you know, he was asked a couple of weeks ago about players who'd come back, like maybe even slightly early from injury. So some people might remember Jordan Nobbs turned her ankle in a very similar way to how Thomas Partey did on the same day at the Emirates in pre-season against Chelsea. And that looked horrible. I was really thinking, oh God, have we lost Jordan for the whole season? And look, I'm not putting it down to Gary Lewin that, you know, obviously there was some fortune, I guess, in the diagnosis, but she's back like probably ahead of schedule. Quite a few players have come back. Players that were out for a lot of last season. Vicky Schneiderbeck played on Wednesday evening. She's been out since November. So again, it's too early to say that's definitely down to Gary Lewin and something has definitely changed there. It might just be variants and we'll know more in a couple of months, and players will get injured because they're playing every 3 days now till Christmas. But that really does seem to be at a really, really critical signing. And not least, not just because of the injury management side, but with this new style of play, which is more demanding physically, particularly on the forward players. And Jonas knows that. because he's been playing that way his whole career. He understands the demands he's putting on them. So I think Gary and other members of staff that they've added in the back room have been really, really critical to that process.
The players have to get on board with that idea of rotation as well, though, don't they? Because we can sit here as pundits or fans or whatever and think about, well, you know, it makes all kinds of sense, you know, to rotate players and bring players in and leave players on the bench. But players want to play. Pretty much every player wants to play as much as possible. So that is going to be a challenge. I think you're right to say there are going to be inevitable injuries, aches and strains, suspension or two along the way, and that kind of eases that pressure. But it is going to be maybe a challenge as the season progresses when you do have that amount of quality in the squad, which is, on the one hand, a really, really good and positive thing, but on the other, that quality wants perhaps to play a bit more. So it is something he's going to have to contend with.
It is. I think the answer to that is fairly constant rotation in terms of, you know, he made 8 changes for the Spurs game compared to the Man City game. But I think his line will be, there's another game on Saturday.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if you didn't play in this one, you'll play in the next one. And I think he's very willing, like, he will not have a starting 11 in mind. There'll be 2 or 3 players like Vivian Miedema, Kim Little, like Leah Williamson, players like that who will play most games. But I think the message is, there are plenty of minutes to go around. I think there are 2 other key things here. From speaking to players over the last couple of seasons under Joe, when perhaps there wasn't quite as much rotation, players do want to play, but they also want to compete. They're weird footballers, I find, with like how competitive they are, and they want, like most of us in our jobs don't fucking want that, do we? we just want to get away with doing as little as possible, quite frankly. But like, elite sports people are freaks, frankly, and they want to be pushed. And this is something that a few of the players have kind of said or implied over the last couple of years, that kind of, no, like, I want to be pushed. I take that as a challenge when someone comes in, because I know it raises my level. But also, this is the first year that the Champions League has a group stage for women's football. So what happened previously was it was straight knockout. So you'd go into a round of 32, then 16. So there's 4 extra games been added in the Champions League in the autumn. So that there's more club football than ever. The other thing that's happened might sound slightly counterintuitive, that on Wednesday night what Arsenal played was an FA Cup quarterfinal. It's from last season's FA Cup, because they had to suspend the women's FA Cup. So if Arsenal get to the final, which they should now because they've been drawn at home to Brighton in the semis, that's another 3 games during the winter that don't usually happen, where they're finishing up last season's FA Cup. And then in January, it all starts again. So, like, it's kind of unprecedented the amount of club games there are. Typically in the women's game, there are a lot more internationals in the women's game than there are in the men's game. So there's still games, but not quite as many. So actually the demand on players is going to be greater this season. And like I said, in Arsenal's case, Arsenal had 9 players at the Olympics. So 9 players spent their whole July and June as well in Tokyo playing Olympic football, doing all of the pre-Olympic friendlies. Like, 9 players in that squad have had no time off basically this summer. And there's a Euros next summer. And then there's a World Cup the year after that. So there's like 3 tournament years back to back. A lot of those players aren't going to get any rest for like 3 years. So it is more important than ever that they're rotated and they're fresh. And I think the players know that that will bring the best out of them as well. It's something Vivian Miedema again pointed to in pre-season. She kind of said, maybe I won't have to play every minute of every game anymore. And look, Viv's in a position where she can say that because she knows that she is the first choice striker. Nobody in the world is taking that role away from her. So I guess she can maybe, I don't want to say afford to be blasé, but, you know, she can kind of say, yeah, I need a rest once in a while. Whereas other players who are perhaps in more competition don't have to. But nevertheless, I think the players welcome it. I really do.
Well, you mentioned Vivian Miedema, and you referenced earlier players with 1 year left on their contracts who Arsenal are trying to convince to sign on. Is it simply a case of Arsenal being a team where she feels she can compete for and win the highest honors in the game? Like, if that is apparent to her, do you think Arsenal's chances of convincing her to sign a new contract are good?
100%. That is what it's all about. Arsenal are simultaneously lucky and unlucky in this respect, in that Viv will not just go anywhere from what I can pick up. She won't just go to Lyon and say, all right, I'll go there and win the championship. I mean, I don't know, she might go there, but like a lot of players will take the Lyon option because they're like, okay, I'll win the Champions League there. I think she's a bit more selective. She's very interested in the style of football teams play. She's very interested in the league, and she's very interested in like where they're situated. She's very settled in London. I know that. I know she likes London a lot. I know she likes Arsenal a lot. So like Arsenal, they definitely have a chance if they can convince her, but it will not be a case of throwing money at it. That I can tell you. And in one respect, that's maybe where Arsenal are unlucky, because Arsenal could make the decision, do you know what? We'll just throw the absolute bank at you to keep you here because it's worth our while. That won't convince her. Mm. It's not really about money either. So, you know, she's much more a player who will take other things into account. But the thing is, she's 25 now, so she knows her next contract are her peak years.
Mm.
And, you know, even as an Arsenal fan, for Vivian Miedemann not to win the Champions League at some point in her career would be an absolute travesty. It really would. She should have won it already, like pretty much every year, to be honest. She's the best player in the world. So, really, that's the kind of the question, I think. Can Arsenal compete at that level? Can Arsenal take on the Lyons, Chelsea as well, who are, like, I mean, two of them are in the division at the moment, in Chelsea and Man City. So there is like a regular kind of barometer there. But Arsenal have also drawn Barcelona, the defending champions, in the group stage this year and play them next week. That will give you a really good indication of where Arsenal are against the best team in the world. Those two games, I think, will be quite important. They'll be really useful for Arsenal because, frankly, they're probably not going to win either of them. But it will tell us a lot about where Arsenal are in that kind of respect, in terms of the best team out there.
Well, you know, when they've beaten Chelsea, who are champions last season, beaten Man City, but didn't just beat Man City, demolished Man City, you know, 5-0. The trajectory appears to be, you know, going in the right direction. Obviously, those Barcelona games, I think, will be very interesting and very exciting, I think, as well. You're going, and we'll have plenty of coverage for us on Arsblog News. When is the next Arsenal Women Arscast? Do we know yet?
So, yes, we're probably going to drop a bit of a Barcelona preview early next week before I fly out. Alex, one of our co-hosts, is an absolute expert on all things Barcelona. So we'll probably drop a short Barca preview for you early next week.
All right. Before we go, it would be remiss of us not to just reference, you know, the last three games that Arsenal have played, and in particular the game on Sunday, the 3-1 win in the derby, without wanting to go over all of it again. And obviously it was very exciting and very enjoyable, and we're all still having a good time and a good laugh at the expense of them. What was, for you, like the main takeaway from that game, based on what we'd seen against Norwich, what we'd seen against Burnley, and the sort of overall situation that the football club found itself in, Mikel Arteta found himself in, the players found themselves in? You know, it felt like there was a lot to prove, in particular with that Tottenham game. So your main takeaway from it, if you can distance yourself from just the sheer happiness of winning that game.
Yeah, indeed. I think we all had a big red ring around the calendar for this game, and more so than ever for a North London derby, because I think we all knew how pivotal this was and how much of a measuring stick it probably is for where we are, because whether we like it or not, we're in direct competition with Spurs in terms of the league table, and probably will be again this season. So I think we all knew, and I think a lot of us were kind of holding back after Burnley and Norwich and saying, okay, only Burnley, only Norwich, let's see what we do here. This is the game where it really matters, and not just because of the local pride angle, but because of, you know, Spurs are in a similar position to us, really, or at least they have been for the last few years. So, you know, some of those things that maybe some of those doubts. I don't know over those two games. I remember talking about the Norwich game and kind of saying we won't know whether this was just a fluky 1-0 win over the worst team in the division or the first building block. We won't know that for a couple of weeks. I think we can say that that's the building block now. Mm. I think my main takeaway from it, though, is not in terms of looking back, it's in terms of looking forward. And the first thing is the level of end product from some of those players like Smith Rowe and Saka, who we know are talented players, but we know they need to come up in that respect, especially when you take a player like Pepe out of the team. But for me, like, this Spurs game has to act like the beginning of something, not the culmination of something. So it makes me think of that Chelsea game on Boxing Day last year, which was a very similar game, actually, yeah, where we go 3-0 up and then Chelsea get one back. But and how that behaved as a springboard, and that made the penny drop, and it propelled us to like 3 or 4 months of really good form. That's what this has to do. So as fun as Sunday was, and I'm still kind of basking in it a little bit, I think, like everyone else, at least until Saturday, what has to happen now is that has to be the start of something. And I think what's really interesting, when you look at what Arsenal and Spurs did, Spurs left all their new signings on the bench. Arsenal started all of their guys. And I loved that tweet from, I think it was Sam Dean, about 6 new signings and 5 guys that Arteta gave a contract to.
Yeah.
I think something he's really done since the international break is almost have a bit of a cordon sanitaire around his team and say, right, these are my guys now. Mm. And even like Lacazette, and I'm not saying like he's banishing the others or telling them to F off or whatever, but it's like some of those guys aren't even coming off the bench at the moment. I think there's been a real sense of, right, these are my guys, and I know I'm going to have to rely on the others at other points in the season, but it's almost like when a manager closes the dressing room door, it's like, right, you're my guys. You're the guys I'm counting on. And for the next few weeks, we're just going to do things this way and we'll integrate the others later on. But this is what we're going to do now. And I really think that's had some value. I really do.
Yeah, I mean, it was almost like, it's very difficult to say it's a clean slate, but, you know, when he did make the changes that he made for the Burnley game and he brought in Ramsdale, and it was like, okay, right, he's blowing some of the cobwebs away here, and he's, you know, finishing games with all 6 of the new summer signings on the pitch, and like you say, players that he's given contracts or contract extensions to and everything else. I'm really curious to see how it plays out with those other players, though.
Yep.
Like, does this create a healthy competition? Does this make them redouble their efforts? You know, what does a Rob Holding, a Pablo Marie think when, you know, they know basically that in Premier League terms anyway, as long as they're fit, Ben White and Gabriel are going to play? Do they fight hard? Do they make that competitive environment? You know, what does Bernd Leno do? All of those things I think are going to be fascinating as the season goes on, because he is going to need these players at some point.
Yeah, and again, I think that's really valuable, though, because there you sort the wheat from the chaff of your squad players, because ultimately, a lot of those guys, someone like Lacazette, he's still playing for his next contract. It's not going to be at Arsenal, but he knows that a year on the bench means that lovely fat Bosman contract gets a little bit, gets like a little bit thinner.
Yeah.
And then like Leno, if someone like Leno, for example, and I don't mean this as a criticism of the guy at all, I love the fact that Ramsdale came in, because I'm not invested in Leno anymore, because he's going to leave, and that's fine. Like, I'm not saying like, therefore I hate him.
Yeah, I know what
or
you
anything,
mean.
But it's like, he's not our guy anymore. Lacazette's not our guy anymore. So for me, particularly without Europe, I kind of don't care what those players do, because whatever they do, like if Leno fights really hard and tries to get his place back, brilliant, absolutely great. That benefits everyone. If he kind of doesn't and just says, well, I'm going to leave, brilliant, fine, he's out. Like, I really think now we're coming to a stage where it is either you're in or you're out.
Mm.
And, you know, getting rid of some of those guys, I'm not calling Leno and Lacazette squatters. There are other squatters who I won't name, Kolasinac.
I mean, he has got rid of some, you know, some players who people, you know, liked, some divisive players at the same time. He has fairly well sculpted this squad to his own liking, hasn't he? Yeah. So it's now, like we were saying, he's got to deliver on it now because he's been allowed to, like, do what he did to Guendouzi or Ozil or whatever people want to think about that. You know, he was allowed to do that. He was given the authority to do that, but now it's absolutely got to be backed up with the results.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And there are other players as well, like Elneny. He's got 1 year left on his contract. And why give him game time now? And it doesn't, I don't think we will. I think it will be Lokonga. It will be like, right, this is the guy we've invested in. Go for it. And so that's probably the next phase of this project. I think what we've got is a kind of core of 12 or 13 starters, and the rest of it is probably going to be filling out some of those squad roles now because we've got players on the bench like Lacazette, like Leno, like Kolasinac, like Elneny, who aren't going to be there much longer. And so filling out the squad, that will be the next bit. And that might be a problem. That might, you might have guys who are like not all in and everything like that. I think that's a temporary problem. And if you're going to have that problem at any time, have it the year that you're not in Europe. And, you know, hopefully you don't have to worry as much about them. And, you know, with Xhaka's injury now, Lokonga's got another, like, Lokonga, brilliant start for him in terms of opportunity because first party was injured. Now Xhaka's injured. He's got a really good chance to impress, and we've got a really good chance to see what level he's at the moment. And that's all good. That is all good as far as I'm concerned. This is stuff that's needed to happen for a long time. And now I just don't think we have as many of those players who are kind of half in, half out, here only for the contract and the gym privileges and stuff like that. There's a couple of those still around. But I think we're just moving to a stage now where it is a bit more, you're either in the tent or you're out the tent. And I don't think the out of the tent stuff is going to be as divisive as like Ozil or Guendouzi or players like that. It's going to be, well, your contract's up in 9 months, so I don't really give a fuck whether you're happy or not.
Yeah, it was a bit like what happened with Sylvain Wiltord in the last year of his contract at Arsenal. You know, Arsene Wenger just said, well, you're not going to be here next year, so, you know.
See you later.
See you later. I'm not going to play you. All right, look, we better leave it there. Things obviously positive for Arsenal women, beginning to look up for the men, and we'll catch up soon. Tim, thanks a million.
My pleasure as always.
Thank you to Tim. You can find him on Twitter @Stilberto, but you knew that already. Arsenal Women Arscast coming on Monday as they prepare for a big, big game in the Champions League against Barcelona. You will find the best coverage of that on Arsblog News, which handily is at the easy-to-remember URL of arsblog.news. So bookmark that. Right, I am going to leave it there for this week. As ever, thank you very much, as always, for listening, for downloading, and all the rest. We will have a Brighton preview podcast over on Patreon later on Friday afternoon. Myself and Lewis Ambrose, as always, looking ahead to our next Premier League encounter, and hopefully this is a game from which we can take all 3 points, continue to build on what we've done over the last couple of weeks, and just sort of reinforce some of the good things that are happening about us. And I think we owe these guys one, to be honest, at their place. So let's keep fingers crossed for that. Do join us for the Patreon preview, patreon.com/arsblog. For now, though, take it easy, and we will catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Now, with news of an extraordinary scientific discovery, I'm joined by the esteemed editor of the Scientific Journal of Science, Professor Godfrey Twatchlock. Professor Twatchlock, good afternoon.
Hello.
Professor, please fill us in.
Well, I have to say this is completely groundbreaking because it's very rare that you can combine three things like science, sport, and travel. And that's exactly what we've done. First thing we did was we fed enormous amounts of data into a supercomputer. Now, if you're aware of what a computer is, you don't need to be a genius to realize that a supercomputer is even better than an ordinary computer. So, we put all the information into this supercomputer. Mountains and mountains and terabytes and gigabytes of data about one particular football team into the supercomputer. To that, we added location data. Now, location data can be used for nefarious purposes by the likes of Googles and Facebooks and those kind of companies, but we did not use it for nefarious purposes. We tallied the information and all the data with this one particular football team and every single destination that they have ever been to.
Well, that does sound fascinating, Professor, but what did you find?
Well, it's very simple, really. We found that Tottenham get battered everywhere they go. Tottenham get battered everywhere they go. Everywhere they go.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
And that they're complete cunts.